Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
Well, Rob, how are you today, please?
Today, Russell, I am feeling critical.
Ooh.
Like a chief art critic.
Ooh.
That's what I'm feeling. I'm also feeling slightly thirsty. And I don't mean for water, I mean for knowledge.
Attention.
And for art. Yeah, I'm always thirsty for attention. But yeah, I'm also slightly thirsty for knowledge. And today's guest has taught me a lot. And I adore her. And I first met her properly. I mean, I think we probably had met or sat at least at dinners in London over the years. But we properly connected when I opened the gallery here in Margate in 2019. And they were working, our guest was working on a book called Art London, which came out that very year.
Mm.
And I was really impressed by the book. I thought it was A, beautifully designed, and just really, it was a very usable book and sort of very concise, but at the same time, very full and rich with detail. And that was my first kind of, I mean, aside from having read articles, because obviously today's guest is a regular contributor to The Guardian's art pages, does really full length, stunning portraits in words of different artists and different topics in the art world. And is also the chief art critic now of the British daily newspaper, The Eye, which we all know and love, and has written for all kinds of magazines like Freeze, an Art Monthly, Art Review, Apollo, like you name it, this writer has contributed and made an impact. But more recently, they have written books on Frida Kahlo, who everyone listening to this podcast will know is my all-time hero. And we were supposed to interview our guest around I would have, well, that would have been a dream. But yeah, we were meant to talk to today's guest around that book. And then also, you love Caroline Walker a lot and introduced Caroline to the podcast. Mm. We interviewed them around that time. This guest has also contributed to Caroline's
Janet.
Yeah, Janet book. Exactly. There's so many. But more recently, there's a few other books which we're going to be talking about. One focuses on motherhood and sort of prioritizing and caring for parents within the art world and how we can sort of really discuss that more, because it's been something that's been overlooked and quite terrifyingly in a way, and shockingly, people have been persecuted for being parents really in the art world. So I'm looking forward to talking about that. And there's also a new book which we will discover, and I know you're going to love that new book, Russell Tovey.
Yes.
So we would like to finally welcome to Talk Art Hetty Judah.
Hi Hetty.
Hello. Wow, what an introduction.
How are you?
I'm very well. I'm quite tired. I've just been on a 3-week speaking tour of Europe talking about art and motherhood, and it was wonderful. And I traveled by train, but I'm a bit tired now.
You're such a rock star. You're doing a rock tour around the world.
Yeah, well, I'm a mum star. You can't be a mum star, can you? Actually, that's one of the things I'm trying to fight against, because obviously mums are considered as the antithesis to cool, and we've got to do something about that, I think.
To me, I think they are definitive of what is cool. Me and Rob both love our mums. Our mums are our biggest champions. For me, discovering more about how being a mum affects your ability to progress within the art world is really upsetting, and obviously something that I feel shameful for not knowing more about, because obviously I'm not a mum. And your manifesto, which I've been following, is that it's so easy to ignore it if it doesn't affect you, but it affects other people so much.
Yeah, it's very easy to ignore an absence if you can't see it and you're not feeling it. You know, you don't realize that it's happening. But I mean, it goes right from real prejudices around the mother as a cultural figure. So we tend to think of the mother as a kind of comic cultural figure, somebody that's, I mean, I know you're both wonderful sons and you both adore your mothers, but in broader kind of cultural terms, when we think about going to see some stand-up comedy, you know, the comedian's quite often making jokes about their mum being overbearing or
it's
being
the mother-in-law, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, but also the mother themselves as well as being, you know, caring too much, worrying about things, interfering, nagging, having like weird quirks. And this idea that the mother's somebody that can make a serious cultural contribution is something that's quite alien. And there's not really a paradigm of the artist's mother for people to point to and go, yeah, that's what I am, you know. And of course, we're now starting to see people like Alice Neal getting more celebrated. And we can go, yeah, Alice Neal, she's an artist's mother. And, you know, that's what I'm doing too. But it's not as a paradigm socially, it's not something that's very present. And there's been this long-held idea that making art about motherhood or the domestic sphere was kind of lesser art. It was a kind of thing that women did, that mummies did, so it wasn't great. And that's something also that we really need to combat as well.
The thing with Alice Neal, which I always remember, is that she herself sort of said that being a mother was hard. She wasn't like a champion for other mother artists. She was basically saying, don't do it. And I think I've watched documentaries and her kids always seem slightly broken by their experience of having a mother as an artist. And that was of the time, I guess, and what she felt she had to do, which again is the problem of it all.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting. So I've done a very lengthy study. So I've interviewed about initially just over 50 artist mothers about their experiences. So they were people from ages ranging from pregnancy right up to grandmotherhood and of all kinds of different art practice. So some of them were quite well established with commercial galleries. Others were, I guess, much less present in the kind of art world that we spend our time in. And what very often kind of comes to light is that actually the people that are being exclusionary in their behavior, that aren't being good allies, are quite often other women and quite often also older mothers. And there is, I think, this idea that you've been through something difficult yourself, so why shouldn't other people, you know? Well, I coped with it. I dealt with all of that, so why shouldn't you? It's really interesting how this pattern of prejudicial behavior becomes replicated even amongst women.
Yeah, I mean, I think that goes through a lot of careers in the creative industry. I know that a friend of mine's a producer, and there's some other directors who are female directors, and she's like saying, oh, could you want to support younger upcoming female directors to be kind of an ambassador and a role model for them? And they're like, no. It is this mentality that, yeah, I fought hard for this, so why do I need to give you a clear path? It's like an ingrained experience that is like a trauma that they feel resentful in some ways to other people not getting an easy parenthesis route in.
Yeah, I mean, and there's also this difficult thing, you know, obviously, that as feminists we try and push back against quite hard, but growing up we're really often taught as girls that we're in competition with one another. There's not space for a great number of us to thrive. And so actually, you know, we're set at one another's throats automatically, you know, to be critical of the way that other people dress or what they look like or their weight or being outspoken in public or, you know, all their parenting skills. So, you know, we really are taught in a way to take other women down. And so getting over that actually can be a thing in itself, I think, too.
And this is the book, How Not to Exclude Artist Mothers and Other Parents. And there's a quote that you can't have both motherhood and a successful career. So how did this come together for you? What was the first experience when you thought, I need to write about this?
Yeah, so in a way, it's that funny thing where, I went through being a parent and for quite a long time a single parent in the art world, and was very aware of the fact that my male colleagues were advancing beyond me and that they were being taken much more seriously, but they were also going to all of the kind of art world, you know, dinners and the biennials and doing all of the travel that now comes with being part of the art world. And I very much wasn't, and I was kind of sliding backwards at that time. But I guess I just kind of thought that was the way things were. And so in a way, it's been seeing members of the young generation being more public about their status as parents that's emboldened me to an extent, and has I think provoked me to examine the structures that I endured. And then when all of those great studies started to come out a few years ago looking at gender balance in the art world. So there's obviously Charlotte Burns and Julia Halperin's Burns Halperin report, which I think the first one came out in 2018. And there have been the Freelance Foundation reports that have been coming out for about 7 or 8 years now. And I did a lot of reporting on those, and obviously was looking at those with great interest. And it became really evident that the moment at which the fortunes of male and female artists, or should we say male, female, non-binary artists parted company, was really at the point of getting gallery representation. So there were more female and non-binary students of art at GCSE, at A level, at BA level, at postgraduate level. When you get to early career awards like the New Contemporaries, there was rough gender parity. So it wasn't, there was an issue of quality, God forbid. But when it came to representation by commercial galleries, there was this huge shift suddenly. And about 68% of the artists represented by commercial galleries in London certainly are male. And I was really interested as to what was happening between, shall we say, MA, PhD level studies and that moment of getting commercial representation, which, if you're lucky, happens when you're in your, let's say, your mid-30s. And of course, there are other things that quite often happen in people's lives when they're in their mid-30s, and that can include becoming a parent. So it occurred to me that perhaps parenthood was a factor in this. So I was commissioned by Kate McMillan, who was the author of some of the Freelance Foundation reports. She commissioned me to write an essay looking at the impact of motherhood on artists' careers. I started working on it right as the pandemic hit in March 2020. And I put an open call out on Instagram, just wondering whether anybody would be interested in talking about this. And I'm quite lazy. I was probably just going to write an essay and interview about 6 people. And I just got this unbelievable response back. So it was being shared all over the place. The call out kind of went viral, and I was getting a lot of emotional outpourings coming back to me. And I ended up interviewing everybody who wished to be interviewed. So that was just over 50 people. And so, I think, because also in a way, the pandemic made this possible because I was in lockdown. And so I wasn't out there reviewing stuff. I had a self-employment support grant. So my work wasn't being funded by anyone, but it was being funded by, my self-employment support grant. So it made it possible. So that initially turned into an essay called Full, Messy and Beautiful. And I have to say, it was a very, very emotional experience doing all of the interviews. People were very upset. They'd been through extremely difficult situations. So they'd experienced all of the difficulties that any experience of parenting comes with, which can include things like domestic abuse or having children that required extra care, or being in controlling relationships, or having very challenging socioeconomic circumstances, or mental health wobbles, physical health issues, all of that. And then on top of that, you've got the art world, which is basically shuts down on you. And I was talking to plenty of people who, as soon as they became publicly pregnant, their long-standing relationships with curators was being shut off. The curators stopped contacting them. They assumed that they were no longer available and able to participate. People were losing commissions. So, for example, portrait commissions they'd received, and they said they were pregnant. That was removed from them. Performances in international festivals were cancelled. And then once you've taken time out of the art world, particularly if you've got a few children and you do need to take some time off to look after them, there are very, very few mechanisms for coming back into it. So you think about all of the awards and the residencies that are provided for emerging artists and have age limits on them. Those are just not available if you're coming back into the art world in your, shall we say, 40s or 50s. And obviously, middle-aged women are not seen as a particularly hot proposition within the art world. And so I think a lot of people are finding themselves then coming out of their active caregiving days and totally stuck, completely unable to attract the interest of a gallerist, curators, of commissioning bodies, of residencies, of awards.
I think you said that the art world has no HR department.
Yeah.
Which is... when you're talking about this, feels like that is what is missing. You can go to someone and go, hang on a minute, this isn't right. So in 2022, you co-founded the Art Working Parents Alliance, or AWP, which is a nationwide network. Your manifesto is, our hope is that in making our status as parents visible, we can support one another and work towards a more inclusive art world. So that's only last year. But have you felt changes, small or big, within the art world since you've started this alliance?
Yeah, There have been some really interesting changes. So one of the things that I talk about, so there was another, there was like a full-on manifesto called How Not to Exclude Artists' Parents that I worked on collaboratively with a group of artists in 2021. And one of the things that we point out in that manifesto is that the convention of having all events in the art world between 6 and 8 in the evening is completely inaccessible to anyone who's looking after small children. So it coincides with, you know, what people refer to as the arsenic hour, which is when everybody's really ratty and you've got Lego all over the floor and you've got to do tea and bath time and bedtime and, you know.
The arsenic hour.
It's wonderful. I mean, it has some slightly dark possibilities written into it as a term. And what's been really interesting is I've noticed since then that quite a few galleries have started doing openings, for example, on Saturday mornings. Like they're doing brunch openings and they're... The other thing that's happened that I do talk about in the book a little bit is that people have started to hold baby-friendly events. And I make a distinction between a baby-friendly event and a family-friendly event. So a baby-friendly event is, I mean, in fact, we have them in the film world. People take their, you know, people taking their kids to early morning screenings when they're babes in arms. But we've never had that in the art world.
No.
And this is, so these are, so a baby-friendly event is an event that's really addressing the needs of the parent, but they're welcome to bring the baby with them. Whereas a family-friendly event is addressing the needs of the child and the parents are accompanying the child into it. So a family-friendly event's the kind of stuff that we're used to seeing in the big museums where kids are making art or costumes and interacting with the work and the parents are there in a supporting capacity. But a baby-friendly event is something like a talk or a guided tour or a special event that's maybe held at like 10:30 or 11 in the morning. And you can bring your baby with you. And it's explicitly anticipated that there'll be some breastfeeding and there'll be some crying and there'll be some people moving around and probably some like babies crawling up onto the stage or toddlers and like a certain amount of interruption and chaos. And I think what's really interesting is that until... really, like, I'd say literally like 18 months ago, the idea that this might be something that people were attracted with just didn't occur to most arts organizations. So during the tour that I've just done in Europe, I gave it as a provocation to quite a few of the institutions that I spoke at. And I went to the Moderna Museet, which I'm sure you've both visited, which is a fabulous, very progressive modern art gallery in Stockholm. And they had their first ever baby-friendly event. And it was completely wild. And we had like 12 very, very small children in an audience of 75 adults. And there were stage invasions. There were toddlers crawling all over us. It was quite nuts, but also great. And it's really interesting to bring that energy into a museum as well. I was just going to pick up, so I realized that Russell asked me a kind of two-point question and I responded to the second point in it, but I just wanted to clarify something really briefly because you mentioned AWP, the Art Working Parents Alliance. And actually, I should say that the Art Working Parents Alliance is for art workers rather than artists. It can also be for artists who are art workers, but it really came about because in the years that I've been working on art and motherhood, on artist parents, I've had so much communication from people working in other areas in the art world. They might be academics, they could be gallerists, they could be people working in communications or art fairs who have found things extremely difficult and there's been a huge lack of empathy towards their needs as parents. And this can even be, for example, people experiencing miscarriages at art fairs and not being allowed to leave their station or, you know, take time off. There's this expectation that everybody will keep working out of hours or at weekends or travel the whole time. There are people who agree maternity leave at a commercial gallery, never having had a child before and not realizing actually that after 6 weeks, they're not going to be ready to go back to work. They're going to be still required for full-time care. There are academics who take part-time contracts because they're caregivers and who essentially end up finding their careers in stasis and they're not given any support to progress through the organization. So there were all kinds of really bad practices going on. And Art Working Parents really is a network that we established, first of all, so that people could share their experiences to feel they weren't the only people out there. Because in a way, there's been this institutional silence around people's status as mothers and parents. Again, part of that's this whole thing that we have in the art world where it's special in the art world. So you're not meant to complain about, for example, unpaid work being expected of you or you know, lots and lots of unpaid overtime happening, or the fact that we have to do these quite extreme long days, weekend work, vast amounts of travel and all this kind of thing. So we're lucky to be in the art world, so we should put up with the bad pay and the bad treatment and the naughty habits. So on the one hand, it's a network where people can share experiences and support one another, but we're also campaigning for change within the art world. So Joe and I are currently talking to Whitechapel Gallery about holding a symposium in July, at which we will work with HR people, an HR department for the art world, and employment lawyers, trade union representatives. And we're going to, in that, start to put together some, like a toolkit for negotiating and a set of best, you know, code of best practice in a number of these fields. We hope, anyway, that's the aim at this point.
Amazing.
I think I've noticed as well lots of baby nappy changing facilities popping up. I've always seen that sign around galleries, which is something I hadn't really picked up on before, obviously because I don't have a baby to change their nappy. But I feel like there's them incremental changes are sort of being considered now as well.
And one of the things I also talk about a lot in the book is how to make residencies family friendly and the different ways that you can do that. And I've actually also just been over in Switzerland doing some consultancy work for their arts council, Pro Helvetia, about making their residency program family friendly in Switzerland. I mean, I think it's quite interesting that I've had more engagement with the subject in continental Europe than I have in the UK. And we can ask some questions about why that might be, I don't know. But yes, so there is definitely engagement and there have been some changes. And I'm also, I should say, I'm not here, I don't mean to say this to plug myself, but I am currently working on a big Hayward touring exhibition on art and motherhood and an exhibition on it. So there's definitely an appetite, I would say, from a programming perspective to start engaging with this subject now.
You've just got a grant for that, right? This is something that you would, for the book for it, you were struggling to get publishing support and you've just received a grant. I saw that on your website, so congratulations. But also it's kind of sad that a writer like yourself is still struggling to get publishing support.
Yeah, well, thank you. But the Society of Authors grant that I got, I think, was the first proper bit of support for the book that I got. And we still don't have a publisher fully in hand for it, but it's definitely going to happen because Hayward have committed. So the show's opening at Arnolfini in Bristol in February 2024. And hopefully the book will follow either, I think I would hope shortly thereafter. Yeah,
I also just feel like it's win-win for everybody. The more people that get included in the conversation of art, in public art spaces in particularly, in even commercial galleries, private galleries, all of these things, surely it's better for everybody because the conversation's bigger. And if you think of museums, I mean, if they're getting Arts Council funding or all of these things, they have to, like, you know, write up reports about how many people have come through them, what they're doing to engage communities. The community is those children, you know, it is those babies. They are the future of our country, of our countries, plural, you know, and the future artists as well. I mean, it's just, I'm so happy this book happened. The minute I saw it, I remember I was in Curve Coffee Shop in Margate and I saw Hannah Lees, the artist, and we were both at the same time had heard you were writing this book and we were both so thrilled about it. And I feel like it's been a relief for a lot of people who are currently, you know, have toddlers, have young babies, who are artists, who are faced with that fear, even in our generation right now, you know. And I just think it's so brilliant. Also, weirdly, because of the design of your book, I think the cover is so well designed. The actual, like, colour of it, the whole... I often find that with the books you do. Like, I think they're quite inviting and you almost want to pick them up. If you know what I mean.
It's quite funny because the How Not to Exclude Artists' Mothers is actually part of a series called Hot Topics in Contemporary Art.
Yes.
So they've got a fairly set format. And so all they do is they offer you the colours. So I was going to, and this it was the only, should we say, like, feminist text in that series. So I was like, oh, don't make it pink, for God's sake. And I was like, actually, no, make it pink. Make it red and pink. Make it look like a fanny. Come on.
Rob loves those books that look like fannies. Rob's like, give it to me.
I
now.
Do. You do. And I love, well, you know that I love women artists as well, and non-binary artists and trans artists. Like, that's always been a big passion of mine in my own collection. But I just am thrilled because I just think it's about time. But the other thing I've been loving, which I know you've just mentioned, you're curating this exhibition, but I'm loving your Instagram feed lately, where you're introducing us to different paintings from history, things you might have seen on your travels recently, relating to motherhood, parenthood. There's some amazing examples. And even recently, Chantal Joff painted Antonia showering with Katie Hessel, actually, the other great young writer and almost like an art critic from Great Roman Artists. But there are these beautiful paintings of Antonia just as she's, you know, fully pregnant. And I'm loving all of this being included in art being made now, but also when you look back, how it's always been there. But I feel like I never saw those works before.
I mean, you say it's always been there. To be honest, so I quite often set myself this task of going through an entire collection, looking through the lens of how is motherhood represented here. And it's not that present, I must admit. So I think there were very, very few paintings, for example, of pregnant women until quite recently. And there was a bit of a kind of taboo around it, I think.
So
we have symbolic mothers. We have mothers turning up as, so you've got the Roman figure of Charity who breastfed her father.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
And quite often there are like genre paintings of women breastfeeding where it's basically an excuse to have their boobs hanging out. I mean, like every Rubens painting, it's like, oh my God, somebody's attacking our town. My boobs have fallen out because I was breastfeeding my child. And so there are just kind of like tits flying everywhere. You know, so there's, you know, like as with the kind of the Madonna and child, it's quite often like an excuse to ogle someone. And then you obviously get kind of like really political engagements with motherhood, particularly around quite nationalistic paintings that are happening in the early 20th century. And indeed, before that, there were a lot of responses to the idea of the new woman, so the liberated woman, and the fact that she needed to instead look to her destiny as a breeder and a homebody. So it's quite interesting that there are very few kind of just straight up celebrations or engagements with the reality of motherhood until, you know, really until, I mean, actually Frida was the first one, your beloved Frida, Rob. She painted that amazing picture of herself experiencing a miscarriage. And then also painted herself being born, which I think is the first like full-on painting of somebody giving birth in that way.
Wow. Yeah. My birth. Yeah, it's my favourite painting.
Yeah.
God, that's so interesting. How did Frida Kahlo come into your life then? If we think about the other book you've written, I think it was out in 2020. What was it that drove you to write about Frida?
I mean, she's an absolutely fascinating character, but I think... in fact, it really started when I did a piece about that amazing show that was the V&A that I'm sure you both saw, where they had a lot of the stuff that was kind of found quite recently within the closed off rooms in the Blue House in Mexico City. So there was a very large section of the house that was closed off for, I think it was 50 years after Diego Rivera's death. And they started to go through it, and it was a lot of personal stuff.
But that was that was in the will or something that you weren't allowed to enter it for 50 years, or?
Yes, I think it was. I think there were two rooms. There was a bathroom and another room. And
oh my God, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So that's where all of this other stuff started to come from. So there were her medical records and her makeup and her clothes. And
why were they? Why did they want to do that? Sorry to interrupt. I'm just like, what is this? Why did they want to shut off everything? Why do they want to let the rest people around the rest of the house potentially, but not into these rooms? And have stuff been discovered that's really like shocking?
I mean, I'm not sure I can be put on the spot in a very adequate way on this, but from memory, basically Diego Rivera he had cancer and he died not too long after Frida. At this point, Frida wasn't, you know, she wasn't this kind of like iconic figure that we have now. She had some modest success in her lifetime. She'd had a good show in New York. She'd had a fairly so-so show in 1939 in Paris. Right before she died, she was celebrated in Mexico City. But Diego Rivera ended up leaving all of her paintings to the National Bank of Mexico, something really strange. And the house was more of a kind of curiosity, a public curiosity for a long time. It wasn't particularly strictly policed, and so I think a lot of stuff got pilfered when people used to visit it. And it was only really kind of in the late 80s and 90s that she started to be rediscovered and reappraised. So her work was quite invisible before that point. I think the rooms that were shut off contained personal stuff, and I think the idea was that it could be accessed after everybody that might be involved in it had died. That's quite often the way these things go. And a lot of it was really small things like, you know, medicines and lipsticks and kind of personal effects and personal letters and photographs. Actually, they're amazing photographs. So anyway, so in that show that they had at the V&A, which came out of that trove, there were her medical prostheses. And I think what was really striking was that, you know, Frida had become such a pop cultural figure at that point, and she was very rarely, in fact, pretty much never portrayed as a woman who'd gone through amputation, as a woman with living with disability, as a woman living with quite severe spinal injury, as a woman who used a wheelchair at times. And I was quite interested as to how she was very much picked up and embraced by disabled women as a result of that show and those artifacts becoming public. And I became quite interested in her as a kind of almost a universal symbol, because she's in many ways very enigmatic, because she's almost a self-created icon. You know, she constructed this persona of Frida Kahlo that was the public face. And so people project onto her very freely. And I think, you know, whether you've been heartbroken or badly treated in love, or whether you've suffered grief, or whether you've suffered illness, you find her an incredibly strong and moving figure. And also if you've, you know, perhaps experienced miscarriage, and if you've had, and also had, I think, ambivalence about having children as well. So there is a lot of this kind of human side to her that people find extremely compelling. And I was quite interested in looking kind of behind the myths and seeing what there was to discover of her.
Yeah, for sure. I always remember that early story as well of her having polio, and how that sort of began these kind of, and then obviously the bus accident. There were like so many events in her life that somehow, all these challenges. And I remember when I first discovered her in the 90s via the pop star Madonna, because Madonna had started talking about her work. And for me, it was this message of that you can survive, that you can, even in the darkest of times, and, you know, it doesn't matter what life throws at you, whether it be, you know, your physical body, but having disabilities or whatever it may be, but like somehow that through art, it kind of gives you a purpose and a drive and a meaning behind all the sadness somehow. And I think I was really, really, as a 13-year-old, it just spoke to me in the way that like music would also, you know, Tori Amos talking about rape or all of these kind of big issues. But it's the women that made a difference.
You know, women, iconic women through history are the ones that myself and Rob, and I think many people have, many gay men have connected to more than male role models. You know, there's definitely the patriarchy, we kind of fought against it, and the women that have come along and changed the game and been outspoken. And
I know, because they're always so forthright. Persecuted.
Yeah, they're the ones that you're like,
hundreds of years. Yeah. It's like, yeah. And I think we definitely as gay men feel a solidarity with
them. Yeah,
women,
we met through Tracy Emin, which is, you know,
our
Frida Kahlo in some ways. She shares certain, you know, qualities, definitely. So you're an art critic as well. And for people listening, I would love to just get a dummy's guide to what an art critic is and does. And do you decide what you get to critique, or do the publishers of the magazines you write for and the publications you write for tell you what to do?
Okay, that's a multi-point question there. So I'm going to start from the end, Russell. So in terms of what I get to review in the papers, I pitch. So I send a list of the shows that I think are maybe compelling to, for example, the Eyes readership, and the editor then chooses what she is most drawn to. And The Guardian quite often will approach me about things it wants me to review, because so obviously The Guardian has Adrian Searle and Jonathan Jones as its two kind of main critics, but they'll quite often approach me to do other things. So there is a degree of, with the papers, there's a degree of choice, but not like open choice. I very much can't just review whatever I want. And I think in making the suggestions to the newspaper, I'm very aware that, for example, the Eye might only carry 4 reviews a month, and that our readership is spread around the UK. So it will be the 4 most important shows of that month and not fully London-centric. So those also are lenses that you need to kind of apply to what you're writing about. For kind of like the art magazines like Frieze and stuff, you have more freedom in terms of you can pitch things that you think are interesting rather than simply like the big banner headline shows. and more works at commercial, they're more likely to cover works in commercial galleries. Again, you have to pitch it there. You can't just write something. The only place where I have a certain degree of freedom like that is in my column for Apollo. So I have a monthly column for Apollo where it tends to be less of a kind of rapid response thing. So it's not a review, but it tends to pull out kind of themes that I think are really interesting at the moment. So for example, in the most recent one, I've looked at artists engaging with history and using the artfulness of art to take a look at what's usually written out of what we think of as historical accounts. So that's, I looked at Mohamed Sami, who I'm sure you've both seen at Camden Art Centre, which is a really outstanding exhibition. I think one of the best shows in London at the moment. And also an artist called Christopher Kulendran Thomas, who had a show at the ICA and Cave in Berlin. And I think his work will be showing in Zurich in the summer. And he did a film that was, well, a film and installation work that was looking at like recent historic incidents in Sri Lanka and particularly the perspective of the Tamil people that had been completely erased. And so he'd created various levels of artifice within the work. So there was some deep, there was a deep fake of Kim Kardashian that popped up that was very evidently artificial. But then there were also reconstructions of, for example, female combatants training and giving answers in a documentary film that looked quite plausible, but on reflection were probably staged. And I think he was, like Mohamed Sami, there's this thing of, you know, how much is constructed in our understanding of history and how much does each generation write history in its own image? And what can the fictional realm, the made-up realm of film or poetry or art bring to this world of history, which we tend to think of as the hard world of fact, but you know, that actually these other dimensions really add to it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast. And we're here today with Budweiser beer. And we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
they've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
Sorry, so that was quite a long answer to your the second part of your question. The first part of your question in terms of what is art criticism? When I talk about this, I do lecture a bit about art writing, I tend to start with a critical hero of mine, not an art critic, but a critical hero of mine, which is the character Anton Ego, who crops up in the film Ratatouille, which I'm sure you're both far too learned to have seen, but it's a great great favourite of mine. It's a Disney Pixar movie.
I've actually seen it over Christmas a few years ago. I loved it.
If you're not acquainted with it, it's about a plucky young hero and his best friend, who's a rat, and they are the underdogs, and they end up kind of starting a restaurant together in Paris. And the great kind of counterbalance to that is this character, the critic, called Anton Ego, who looks a bit like kind of Will Self and is this very kind of skinny character in a dark jacket that kind of looms over people and casts a long shadow, and it's very kind of pithy. And there's this kind of great moment towards the end of the film where, you know, the plucky young hero Linguini has set up his restaurant and everybody's abuzz about it and he'll think it's wonderful, and suddenly this shadow is cast across the restaurant and Anton Ego comes in through the door and he kind of strides purposefully down the middle of between the tables and looms over Linguini and he says, "You're awfully small to be the next big thing." And Linguini looks up at him and says, "You're awfully thin for someone who likes food." And Anton Ego looks down at him and says, "I don't like food, I love food, and if I don't love it, I don't swallow it." And so in a way there's that actually for me is a really great encapsulation of what being a critic's all about, which is that actually you're somebody that really loves art and, you know, you feel incredibly passionate about it, you engage with it, and you really want to meet the artist intellectually, to engage with what they're doing aesthetically, to really kind of bury yourself in it. But when there's something that's not right, that's not all it should be, that's being overhyped, that's, you know, that you don't want to swallow, that's when you respond to it critically in that way. So obviously being critical isn't just about criticizing things, but it is, I mean, it can fulfill many functions. When I'm writing for the daily papers, it can simply be a question of, my readers have £14 to spend on an exhibition this weekend, which exhibition should I tell them to go and see? And when should I tell them to save their £14, you know? But it can also be that you're engaging with an artist who you think has something really interesting to say, but that perhaps is saying it in such a new and experimental way that actually people need a little bit of kind of guidance to bring them into it, and perhaps that you become more like an interpreter on a certain level as well.
Tell them how to see.
Well, not tell them how to see, but kind of
allow them how to see. You know, once someone will encourage them, help them how to see.
Encourage them to look.
All right, fine. Yeah. But it's like when you look at a painting with someone, they go, "I don't get it," and you just go, "Well, it's these colours because the artist felt like that," and suddenly it opens a little door, and someone feels like, "Oh, okay, they can be critical of it, or they can appreciate the story within it," and then it becomes theirs. So that you know, that's, I guess, you're encouraging. A critic is always encouraging someone to discover more. But do you ever feel bad about writing a bad review about someone? And have you ever been in the situation, like recently there was that thing, what was it, Berlin, where that director threw dog shit into that critic's mouth or something, whatever, her face, and he got arrested and then struck off. But I mean, obviously, you know, no one's done that to you, I hope. But do you feel like you might enter a room after a bad review and there's a sort of tension if you go to an institution where you've been critical of them?
I think quite often, actually, and I don't know if you guys have experienced this, but you're quite often aware that you're maybe not doing your best work on something. And I think people sometimes do kind of go, yeah, actually, that's kind of fair enough. I mean, more often when I respond strongly, it's when somebody's really getting overhyped and you've got a gallery that's really pushing some extremely bland kind of, you know, nice abstract paintings. It's like, this is just not, you know, you're overhyping this massively. And I kind of then feel bad because it's almost like the artist is getting caught up in a situation that's not necessarily of their own construction. It's the gallery just massively overheating things and pushing them into a position that actually they shouldn't really be put in the first place. Like, it's perfectly fine, but it's not like, oh my God, this is incredible. And, you know, because you often see that. So when you get one painter that's doing something exciting, all the galleries want the same thing. So they get somebody that's kind of like almost identikit. Oh yeah, she's doing like big, colourful, abstract paintings.
You see it at art fairs, don't you, every year? Yeah. It's like the one who's kind of trailblazed and then every other gallery has the same, yeah, you're right, identikit.
It's the same in music. I've never understood it because I'm always like, surely in the end, if you think in as a parallel in music, like there's Amy Winehouse, say, we don't then need 25 Amy Winehouses. Amy Winehouse was Amy Winehouse because she was so singular and so doing her own thing. What we need is to find people who are doing their own thing. And I just think people forget that sometimes.
It's the same with TV shows. They make a TV show.
Yes, it's so
turned
like
down
that.
And nobody's into it. We don't get it. No one to get it. It comes out as a hit. And everyone's like, well, we want a show like that. Can you make
a show?
I know,
but it's just like, so silly. It's so like silly.
Nobody knows what they're doing, really.
So Hetty, was your passion for art and your love for art the thing that led you to writing? Or did you always want to be a writer, like prior to working out what you would write about, if that makes sense? Like when you were growing up, were you someone that like loved writing?
Yes, I definitely loved writing. And I guess I used to like write stories with my friends and kind of you do illustrated stories and that kind of stuff. Funnily enough, when I was at Glasgow, I was quite involved in the performance side of things. So there was some, I guess, more of what you call kind of traditional theatre, but there was a lot, also an awful lot of what in those days was called stuff like physical theatre, but nowadays you would put under the umbrella of performance art. I think it's the kind of stuff that's really moved more into the museum and institutional sphere. So funnily enough, I kind of ended up writing about art through that. So I was performing and then I ended up directing some stuff, and I directed a little festival in Glasgow called Terra Nova. Which is a small, it was a kind of nomadic international festival, and I did the Glasgow iteration of it. And I was in Glasgow really at a time when the art scene was absolutely flourishing. So there was, you know, there was kind of Tramway and the Arches and the CCA were all very active. And we had amazing people like Annie Sprinkle coming over and doing performances, and Michael Clarke doing dance pieces, and Charles Escher, who's now in Eindhoven. He's a really significant curator, but he was curating at Tramway. So I think Douglas Gordon's 24-Hour Psycho was there, but there were also lots of great, amazing performance works. So I was really lucky to be there when there was you don't realize that it's special at the time because it's just what you're living with. But I was really lucky. I was there when there was an incredible scene. And so I think it was coming out of that, I ended up writing about art from that. So I don't think I'd necessarily see myself going into this area of writing. I think if you'd asked me kind of at the age of 13, if I was going to write, I probably would have assumed I would have been doing fiction or something, or maybe drama. The idea that I'd be writing about art in this way is, yeah, it was not foreseen. But I think one thing this is also the reason that it's a really, really compelling thing to do, and this is what keeps you guys in it as well, is that art is a space where you're really engaging with another consciousness. You're engaging with somebody else's thoughts. You're trying to get inside their head and their motivation. And at the same time, you're also being incredibly stimulated aesthetically as well in other ways. And for me, actually, the thing, you know, when I'm looking for work that I really want to write about, what excites me is when I have got absolutely no idea how I'm going to write about it. I don't have a route into it. I don't know how I'm going to engage with it. And that's when you know that you're seeing something that's really exciting and new and doing something that's very fresh that you know. Yeah.
Have you had that recently? You did a review of Jenkin recently.
I interviewed Jenkin. Yeah, I was so excited the first time I saw Jenkin's works. I saw it, the first time I saw it was in Kiss My Genders. And I've been a huge fan. And it was, in a funny kind of way, what's interesting with that is that I definitely went into that going, I have absolutely no idea how to get a handle on this. Part of that, I think, was also, it's not simply the art, which I love, as I say, I'm a great fan. But there was also this consciousness that I felt like I was looking into a subculture that I was very much not a part of, whether that's a kind of queer club scene or the kind of latex fetishism or the masking fetishes or what on earth was going on with all of that cake, which turned out to be incredibly sweet and benign. And it was a friend of his mother's that made these shaped cakes. But there was so much wrongness happening with cake in all of those films. But he's really fabulous. Yeah.
Yeah, we love Jenkin. We're actually hoping to interview them, but it hasn't happened yet, but hopefully this season maybe. So your latest book, amongst all your other incredible publishing highlights, is a new book called Lapidarium, The Secret Lives of Stones. Now, I thought this would, A, resonate with my mum, which I told you about when you were writing it, because my mum studied geology and my whole childhood was about all of her collection of like fossils, but also stones and crystals and rocks and all these things. And then when I met Russell, his early collection before art, when he was a child, was crystals and rocks and stones. So I knew this book was for Russell Tovey as well.
Totally. Rocks and minerals was my jam. And I said to Hetty before we came online that for my 8th birthday, my parents took me to the annual Rock and Mineral Society convention that was in a community centre in Harold Wood. And I was sat there between my parents, and everyone in there was about 1,000 years old, covered in dust.
You're probably very interested in that case. Add one to your collection.
I remember loving it as a kid and growing crystals with alum. And then I would have one of these rock turner things. So you'd find pebbles and you put them in this rock thing with certain solutions you'd add in. It would just like turn and turn. And it had to go in the garage because it was so loud and it was rattling the whole time. And then, you know, like 2 months later, you'd pull the lid off and you'd see all of these polished stones that you've made. Madness. But absolutely just fascinated by it. So this book for me is heaven.
Oh, yeah. I remember somebody coming into school with one of those pebble polishers and being so jealous. They're great, though. Can I make a request that if you manage to find a photograph of yourself age 8, can we put it in the post to go with this podcast?
Yes.
I have to see that.
His all right, my mum. I'll ask my mum. There must be something if I'm all laid out. And yeah.
So this new book has 60 different stones that have influenced our shared history. And it's very much this idea of how stones are connected to the culture that we're so aware of, you know, whether it be giant marble sculptures and the stories behind them or, you know, many different things. Can you speak a bit about how this book came to be?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I was telling Russell earlier, I did a talk with Ingrid Swenson, who was formerly at Peer Gallery last night, and she was talking a lot about how artists are out in front testing the waters and engaging with subjects before other people do, which is very much my experience with this book. So, you know, having worked now in the art world for quite a long time, all these ideas like the Anthropocene, I heard first in the art world, and it then took kind of 10 years for them to come through really into mainstream discourse. So a lot of actually this book, although the book's not an art book, a lot of this book comes from my conversations with artists or artworks that I've seen or projects that I've been party to. And I've noticed, for example, among other things, a great interest in geology that's really kind of filtered through in the last 10 years in the art world. There has been a big interest in what we call deep time, which is taking this extremely long view of world history, right? You know, 4.5 billion year long view of world history. And I think what's interesting with that is that people find it, consolation is possibly the wrong word, but when we're at this moment of climate crisis and we're talking about climate change, taking a much longer view of world history in a way puts in perspective, I think, for people where they feel less anxious, perhaps, if we start to think about deep time and we put our own time on the planet into more of a perspective. There have obviously also been lots of very interesting works made about extractive industries and extractive industries relationship to empire and colony. So, for example, I'm thinking there of Steve McQueen's amazing film work, Gravesend, where he looks at the coltan mining industry and links that back to Britain's involvement and Europe's involvement in the Congo. So Gravesend is the port that Marlowe, the narrator of The Heart of Darkness, departs from. So he links this extraction of coltan, which is a mineral that's used in things like mobile phones and PlayStations, and became kind of out of, it's a rare mineral and became suddenly extremely sought after when all of these, as technology became more sophisticated. There's, there are all kinds of rare minerals that weren't particularly sought after until quite recently. And we're very kind of pinched around our engagement with them, because quite often we're having to deal with unsavory regimes to get access to them. And then there have also been, you know, there's been a lot of interesting kind of thought in the art world and engagement with things like ideas like animism and the idea that materials that we previously thought were inert and lifeless perhaps have a kind of an innate power, and that we should consider them in different ways. And so all of these things really came together and informed the book. So the book is divided into 6 sections, she says, not able to remember how many sections there were in her book. She's looking over there. So it starts off with stones and power, and the way that stones can be expressions of power. That can be architectural. So here in the UK, that is often expressed through Portland stone, which is that very kind of white oolitic limestone. People also can express it through gemstones, royal jewels, crown jewels. And if you are, for example, a despotic dictator, you might then want to cover yourself in what look like crown jewels so that you look like you're a legitimate power. There are also power struggles over mineral wealth. It also looks at the way that we turn to stones when we think about the sacred and magic. And I don't make a kind of strong distinction between magic and the sacred, because I think they're like 2 parts on a continuum, I think. And magic is really it's just elements of another belief system. So the way that we might turn to, for example, stones to look into the future or to commemorate our dead. I also look at stones and storytelling, which is something, in a way, storytelling could have been the presiding theme of the book, because I think this relationship between stones and storytelling is fascinating, because we look at this mineral world and the things that we have no explanation for, like, why are there remains of fish on a mountaintop? Why is there a dragon buried in my rock? And it provokes us to start to tell stories about the world. And even, of course, artifacts from previous civilizations. So axe heads and arrows and stone circles. You know, the new stories grow up around these as well. I think that's really fascinating.
Yeah, like the story of humanity. It's such an amazing, because it's so relevant to the present moment to work out who you are now in this moment by looking at all those like fossils and imprints within.
I love
it's
a
just
fossil.
Mind-boggling. Mm. I know when we were kids, I remember the National History, my mum worked at the History Museum, and I remember they discovered the shape of like a claw of a particular dinosaur. And I can't actually remember what it was. I'll have to ask her, but not that it's much use now.
It was a dinosaur nail, I think.
Yeah, it was like a claw thing, Talon. Yeah. And I remember they then reproduced it using a mould, you know, from the stone, and you could actually have one of these claws, like a toy claw. It was mad. But it's just the idea that kind of connection to history, the way that you can almost like touch it, and somehow that touched that time point. It's so sort of, yeah, you can imagine the writers of like Mork and Mindy were thinking about stones.
What was your favorite specimen, Russell? Was there something that you always wanted and never got, or did you have one that was like your star specimen?
I like lapis because I like the color of it. At Labradorium I had, which I got told was very rare, and I took that into junior school and I said it's very rare, there's only 2 pieces in the world, and the teacher was like, I doubt you've got one of them, Russell, if that is the case. But I got told there used to be a geode gem store in Basildon town centre in the Eastgate, and my mum would allow me every now and then on a Saturday, we'd go up there after drama club, and I'd be allowed like £4, and I would buy all these polished stones, these crystals, and I'm, as I've got older, I've got more fascinated with crystals, like listening to Maureen Paley talk about the power of crystals, and she had this tangerine quartz, and I thought, well, I'll get some of that. So I've got a bit of tangerine quartz now, and I like the story that you have to like bring your crystal home and you clean it under like running water, and then you leave it in the windowsill to absorb the sunlight, and then it becomes your crystal. I love all that shit. That makes me happy. So I just think as a kid it was like pretty things and acquiring a collection of them and looking after them. And
you didn't change, did you, Russ?
No, I've always wanted lots of pretty things around me. Yeah. Hence I hang out with you, Rob.
I know, because I am so pretty. I actually just found a giant rock crystal. It's like purple. I don't actually know what it is, but it's one of those kind of very crystal looking purple.
Like an amethyst, probably a
giant amethyst. So it's huge. It's like probably the size of my head or something. And it was Uri Geller gave it to me when I had an operation when I was about 19, because I grew up with his son Daniel Geller, and he said it was like a healing rock and I needed to have it by my bed. And I still have it. It's actually in my bathroom. And I looked at it the other day and I was like, where is that from? And then I suddenly brought back all these memories. It's quite funny.
Yeah.
What's your favorite stone then?
Me?
Mm.
Oh, it's like asking me to choose between my children. I can't.
You wrote a whole book about them.
So it's not so much the stuff. I mean, I have to say the book's really about the stories rather than the stones themselves in a way. So one of the favorite things that I came across when I was researching the book is just the idea of mineral evolution, which is a really recent idea. I mean, I think it's kind of been in the last 8 years. That they realized that actually there were very few minerals in early Earth. So there were a group of Ur minerals, and that the great proliferation of minerals happened at the same time that there was the first oxygen breathing. So the first cyanobacteria started photosynthesizing. So life had this incredibly intense symbiosis with the mineral world. So when I talk about this kind of separation between the mineral world and living things, and trying to muddy that and confuse that a bit, that's where I'm really fascinated by it. So suddenly when you get all of this oxygen being introduced into the atmosphere, you get this extraordinary proliferation of minerals that happen after that. So thinking about the fact that all of these stones are actually evolving, I think that was so mind-blowing. I think it's such an extraordinary theory to engage with as well. And again, we, in our very solipsistic way as humans, when we talk about life, we tend to think about our own life. But of course, you've got all of this bacterial life that was the great oxygenation event happened 2.5 billion years ago. But that already was the kind of the great trigger for the transformation of our stony world. Yeah.
Have you ever thought of doing an exhibition in relation to stones in contemporary art? Because there's so many artists that work with them now.
Yeah, I think it could be really interesting. So when the book came out in the UK, so it came out in Britain at the end of October last year, and I asked, so I did a series of posts looking at some of my favourite works that I knew of that related to stone. So there were people like Ilona Halperin, who's very geologically minded, and Julien Charrière, and then some naughty ones like Ingrid Berthon One's marble series. But then I also did a call out, and I said, I think I had a bunch of Audible credits. So I said, okay, I'll give five audio versions of the audiobook to people who send me artworks that correspond to some of the themes in the book. And I got this huge flood of works coming in, and there were some really interesting things. So besides all of the works that we're quite familiar with, there's a whole load of stuff being made. And it's, I think it could be a really brilliant and fascinating show, actually. Yeah, I'd love to do that.
Yeah, I do too. And it makes me think back to the Venice Biennale in 2007 when David Altmedged represented Canada, and it was a Canadian pavilion, and you walked inside. And I swear there were loads of like crystals in that or something, because it was such an immersive environment. And I always remember it was almost like they were kind of growing. Like
There's another artist who makes like rotten fruit out of crystals, and I can't remember her name, and she was in the Liverpool Biennale. They're like big cherries or strawberries, but the crystals, it's beautiful, but it's also rotting fruit.
Yes. Is this the artist who's with Josh Lilly? They're kind of beads as well as crystals.
Yes. I can't remember her name.
Kathleen Ryan.
Yeah.
Yes.
Kathleen Ryan.
They're great. I mean,
because they're kind of like grotesque, but
they're
also
repulsive, but they're beautiful.
And
they have that seduction and repulsion at the same time. It's fascinating.
Yeah,
Yeah. I mean, the other stone I always loved was Fool's Gold, just because of the name. And it just made me think historically that so many people would have gone, this is gold. And then what fools? They bought it. And it was just pyrite. Yeah. I love that. I love the name of it. So I always had
God, when I was a kid, I was like a magpie on that. Yeah. I was just like all about the Fool's
Gold. But you were
gold.
The fool.
Yeah. Well, now for Rob, for his new companions, there's a mineral called mica, but I love the fact that it's called cat silver. So you can have cat silver to go with your Fool's Gold.
There you go.
Oh, for window and doorway. Yeah. Who you're going to meet tomorrow when you come and do your talk at Quench?
That's your cats.
Actually, Quench is another gallery. Thinking about parents, like they've done earlier openings of their shows.
Community, like galleries, can be community hubs. Do you know what I mean? It's about making them totally inclusive. The inclusivity of the art world is something that we've set this podcast up for. You're writing about. You know, the whole point is that they're meant to be areas of, you know, discussion and collaboration and enjoyment that open to everybody. So it makes complete sense.
And learning from other people's experiences. Like, that's the other thing. Like, we're all supposed to be open-minded people. Mm. And it's like one of the biggest experiences in life is being a parent, you know, bringing kids into the world. Mm. And then also the opposite side of maybe not being one, but like you're still part of a family, a system or of some kind, even if it's a friend family like Russ and I have.
Yeah, the family we make for ourselves.
What would you say to anybody listening, Hetty, who really wants to be a writer, especially in this kind of art world? Because I think it's such a hard thing to do. I met a writer who wrote a review of the Daisy Paris show a while ago, I think maybe at Sim Smith or somewhere, for Freeze. And they were saying that while it's an amazing thing to do, it's not necessarily something that pays loads of money, hardly pays anything. You might get like 250 quid or something to write a piece, if that. So what would you say to people that want to persist and really believe in the written word, and like what advice would you share?
I mean, I think it is very badly paid, and unfortunately it is this world where we as people involved in music, in art, in the written word, we're up against a whole load of free content online. So we're so used now to not paying for bits of writing or just for looking at images. So we've really come up hard against that. And there are fewer and fewer outlets, for example, for art criticism, as I'm sure you're aware, working in a gallery. I mean, I think the thing is, we also all think of these things as being wonderful creative outlets, but you also need to be extremely professional. So it's that, you know, it's just really basic things like being on time, writing things on length, being easy to work with, knowing what you're talking about. But also, I mean, I think if you're interested in writing about art, the best way really to come into it is from experience of, you know, Amelia, of being around artists. And because each generation in a way needs their own interpreters, they need their own chroniclers. So if you're there surrounded by, you know, artists, if you're really involved in the, you know, the art world of your generation, you will have an individual viewpoint. You'll have an individual voice that's perhaps missing from the conversation. And I think art magazines are always very conscious of the fact that perhaps, you know, their writers are old fuddy-duddies like me, and that they need to have, you know, younger voices. They need an insight into, you know, emerging scenes as well.
Well, we're going to get to our final questions now, Hetty. This has been wonderful. Thank you very much. If you could do an art heist, if you could have any work of art in the world for yourself, what would it be and why? And I also want to open it up to, if you could have any rock mineral, geode, amethyst, you know, agate, anything for yourself, what would that be and why?
I mean, I'm going to go fairly unadventurous. Well, fairly unadventurous. I mean, I think I would have to have the Adoration of the Mystic Lamb.
Where do we see this? What is it about?
That's in St. Bavo's Cathedral in Ghent. It's the earliest European oil painting, possibly the earliest naturalistic rendering of the human figure. It's absolutely amazing. It's in the way that kind of like medieval art quite often looks like everyone's just on drugs the whole time and is very psychedelic. You know, it's the one that they've done a partial restoration of. So it's an altarpiece that's in Ghent by Van Eyck. And it's pretty extraordinary. I saw it a couple of weeks ago when I was on tour, and that was pretty good. Failing that, I mean, I'd be happy to pocket a Cranach. You know, there are quite a few knocking around the museums in Northern Europe. I'm sure one or two wouldn't go, they wouldn't notice one of them disappearing.
And who was Cranach?
He's a Northern Renaissance painter who did a lot of religious and symbolic paintings of, you know, top figures like Eve, Virgin Mary, Christ.
Yeah,
I think, you know, some very small, exquisite Northern Renaissance work.
Quite religious work you'd want then.
I think there's a quality to those those early paintings is just so extraordinary. And I, as I say, it's a slight otherworldliness to them. So it's before you're getting these very idealized figures, perhaps. There's something a little bit curious and mystical to them. In terms of a stone, I mean, it depends whether I was going to wear it. If I was going to wear it, I probably would not turn down an emerald, for example. I can't really see any emeralds in my future. I mean, I, like you, lapis is very extraordinary and has, of course, a very important art world history as well. It's the stone that you make ultramarine from and has that amazing cultural history of having been prized for thousands and thousands of years. So that's, if I'm going for a slightly more accessible option. The other thing I also really fascinated by in the book are gongxi, which are Chinese spirit stones. So I would also be quite happy to have a bit of Lingbishi, which is limestone from Anhui province in China, in an extraordinary formation that I could ponder on my desk.
On your recent tour, I know you've been posting pictures of paintings and artworks relating to motherhood. Is there one in particular that stood out for you?
It was more, I mean, I think I was quite fascinated by, well, I mean, obviously seeing Paula Modson Becker works is always a bit of a treat. So there was a very good Paula Modson Becker mother and child that's at the Neue Nationalgalerie in Berlin. Yeah, I mean, I think it was quite often, particularly in Scandinavia, I was really interested by all of the stuff that I didn't know. And it makes you, it's always a good reminder of how insular we can be in the British art scene and how much we look to America and perhaps Western Europe. And we're perhaps quite ignorant of, you know, things that are happening further east or further north. So I was really interested to kind of encounter some artists whose work I didn't know at all well. Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll go with Paula Modson Becker because it's always, yeah, that's a good one.
I saw you posted that, yeah. So people can see that on your Instagram. Mm. The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
Ooh.
Big questions, Hetty.
I know. This is you're really hitting me with some, like, this is pretty tough. I feel like I'm on hard on the BBC.
Critical questioning going on here, Hetty.
I think possibly a kind of burnt orange. I quite like a burnt orange.
No way.
I thought you were going to say blue because of lapis and the emerald, but burnt orange. Okay.
No. I've got two new vintage chairs, which I've just had reupholstered, and guess what colour they are? Burnt orange. I will show you tomorrow.
You've shown us the cover of Lapidarium and it's burnt orange in
burnt
one
orange.
Section.
One might even say amber.
Amber.
Yeah. Oh,
amber's
gorgeous.
Also a good one because you can get amber and you could get mosquitoes in amber like they did in Jurassic Park and they got the dino DNA. I like amber. That was the holy grail as a kid, was finding a bit of amber with like a bug in it. What's the best advice you've ever received, Hetty, when it comes to your writing or your art?
Best advice I've ever received? I'm not sure anybody's given me advice, actually. I mean, I think kind of generally leaving something and then coming back to it's pretty good if you still like it.
Leaving it for how long?
There was a tutor at university that suggested 7 years, which I think is possibly a little excessive.
7 years? It's like, I'm just going to do a review. Might leave it 7 years.
Yes. I think that's very much this idea that if you're wanting to create some kind of work of timeless genius, 7 years would be a good testing point. So if it still felt really important at that point, then you were onto something.
Well, it's interesting because you spent 5 years mapping the inequality in the visual arts. That was something that you were dedicated to. So in some ways you have kind of followed that advice. You spent many years researching that subject.
Yeah, and I definitely, when I'm thinking about books I'm going to write in the coming years, there'll always be quite a long period of like soft research of accumulating books and artworks, putting artworks in my back pocket, not literally, but, you know, before I kind of work out what the next thing I want to do is. So yes, I've got the two books after that kind of lined up. So
amazing. Cultural force. Well, this has been incredible, Hetty. Thank you so much for coming on.
You're such a wonderful person and such a bright, intelligent, inspiring. I just adore you. I think you're brilliant. And you're just cool. I've always really enjoyed getting to know you over the last few years. I feel like it's since 2019, really. But like, I'm really inspired by everything you're doing. And I also just think everybody listening to this, if you haven't bought Hetty's books, please order them like right now. And the latest one, Lapidarium, the front cover is so gorgeous, isn't it? I mean, who designed that for you? I love that. Was that like in-house at the publishing house?
It's the American cover, and rather naughtily, the British edition doesn't actually credit the design. I do have her name somewhere, and I'll put it in the notes to the podcast when it goes out.
Fantastic.
I'll make sure she's credited.
Good times. Well, thank you, Hetty Judah. And you're on Instagram?
Yes, at Hetty Judah.
Perfect. Very easy. We'll link to you there and we'll be posting images of things we've been talking about today on our Instagram at TalkArt. Thank you for listening. We'll be back very soon. Thank you, Hetty.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank
you.
You've been listening to TalkArt with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to TalkArt at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.